From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
The United States of America is not the only country on earth with violent or dangerous people. We are not inherently more prone to violence. But we are the only advanced country on earth that sees this kind of mass violence erupt with this kind of frequency.
On Tuesday, President Obama finally made good on his repeated threats to try and take our guns away. Or at least that's what some pundits and would-be presidents would have you believe.
The word that President Obama is once again going to abuse his power to try to seize our guns, sadly, surprises nobody.
Moreover, declared Fox News' Andrea Tinteros, the president's tears upon recalling the Newtown massacre were of the crocodile variety.
I would check that podium for like a raw onion or some no more tears. I mean, I just, it's not really believable. I mean, and the award goes too. We are in award season.
But that's immaterial, as well as moronic. What matters is, 2 days later, he took his impassioned plea for action on what he called common-sense gun safety measures on the road in a televised town hall held in Fairfax, Virginia.
If we can combine gun safety with sensible background checks and some other steps, we're not going to eliminate gun violence, but we will lessen it.
In both of his appearances this week, the president stressed the need for action from citizens on behalf of gun reform. But he did not shy away from giving credit for obstruction where he thought credit was due. Here he was on Tuesday.
The gun lobby may be holding Congress hostage right now, but they cannot hold America hostage.
The gun lobby, and specifically its principal representative, the National Rifle Association. Whatever your views on the NRA, it certainly had a lucrative relationship with many members of Congress for a long time. Here's a clip from a piece I reported for NPR's All Things Considered back in 1994 when I was shadowing the late Sonny Bono on his first day in Congress. But Bono is being taken seriously. He even had a visit from the National Rifle Association, a delegation of board members just stopping by to say hey.
We wish to impress upon him the importance of supporting the Second Amendment to keep and bear arms. Our job here is to make sure that he remembers who elected him to office.
That's also Igor Volsky's job, only he's working to ensure that we remember as well. Volsky is a contributing editor to Think Progress. In the wake of the recent shootings, he's taken to Twitter, assiduously connecting the condolences of legislators to NRA cash.
For instance, when Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell tweeted, "The senseless loss of innocent life in hashtag San Bernardino defies explanation. Our thoughts are with the victims and their families."
Volsky tweeted, "NRA dumped $922,000 in McConnell's reelect bid. So when it comes to preventing gun violence, all you get is this tweet."
Igor Volsky, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
Some context first, if we can. Think Progress is nonpartisan, but one of the lefty MSNBC, Salon.com, the nation usual suspects of progressive thought, is it not?
We like to think of ourselves as a progressive research blog that's affiliated with the Center for American Progress here in D.C.
Okay, I'll take that as a yes. Anyway, you weren't always on the gun beat. You actually covered health policy. And now you're all guns all the time. Why?
What really changed for me was Newtown, Connecticut. The way that story broke and the way every single mass shooting has really unfolded from this press perspective. We know what the first story looks like, what the day after story looks like. And so, of course, when the San Bernardino shootings happened and you saw everybody following the same script, including, of course, the Republican lawmakers who expressed their thoughts and their prayers, but do absolutely nothing. That for me was a real tipping point.
And you don't believe this is a coincidence. In fact, you noticed something amid all of these thoughts and prayers tweets and pulled off one of the great Twitter exercises that I can recall on any subject ever.
Well, it turned out that all of the lawmakers who were tweeting their thoughts and prayers voted against expanding background checks in the aftermath of Newtown in 2013. and also, of course, received thousands of dollars from the National Rifle Association. So I just retweeted every lawmaker who expressed their thoughts and prayers and said all they're going to do is think and pray because the NRA pays them to do absolutely nothing else to bring down the rate of gun violence in America.
Now, correlation isn't necessarily causation, but these people have not only not legislated, but in many cases stymied any kind of action that could even lead to gun control legislation. Does that mean that they've been essentially bought off? Are there other explanations for the correlation?
There's certainly some lawmakers who believe very fervently that any kind of gun regulation is an infringement on the Second Amendment, which, by the way, is a very modern notion that originated in the 1980s. But they do believe that. And that, of course, is reinforced by the NRA in their communities and their constituents who may also subscribe to those views. But there are other lawmakers who, in fact, can be bought by the NRA or another interest group that says, hey, if you don't hold this position, not only will we not give you a direct contribution, but we'll also spend very heavily for your opponent. And so I think that the money that I've been pointing out really highlights the entire culture that the NRA creates, and that's a culture of fear.
On the subject of correlations, an overwhelming number of Republicans on your Twitter target list and very few Democrats. Does this break down entirely across party lines?
It does not. Senator Heidi Heitkamp from North Dakota voted against the background check bill. There's also a couple of Democrats in the House, I believe. However, if you look at the general pattern of giving, it's overwhelmingly a Republican gift. And even Democrats who do their very best to try to steer clear of pissing off the NRA, people like former Arkansas Senator Mark Pryor, are in a situation where they vote the right way, but the NRA still turns around and endorses their opponent because it's about guns for the NRA, but it's also about maintaining power of not only the gun issue, but the whole host of issues that animate their membership.
Let me ask you about that, because while gun regulation and legislation have been at a standstill for, I guess, almost decades, the NRA itself is evolving beyond the issue of the Second Amendment into the culture wars writ large.
I would just quarrel a little bit with the notion that gun regulation isn't evolving. It is evolving on the state level. You did have a whole batch of states in the aftermath of some of these shootings, Colorado, Connecticut, that did tighten their state gun laws. It's just that nothing's really happened on the federal front. And yes, the NRA isn't just about guns anymore, as you point out. It's also about God and country and patriotism. That's the frame within which the gun debate is had. They have an entire host of TV programs, of web programs that very smartly pull in the new demographic of Americans, not just the traditional supporters of the NRA, who we may think of as older, whiter, but also now they're trying to appeal to young people through YouTube. They're trying to target women through all kinds of pink guns that they market very heavily, women-centered shooting clubs, and to African Americans by employing entertainers who appeal to that demographic. So they're certainly very interested in keeping their 4 million person membership alive and growing.
Let's get back to your Twitter stream, which wasn't exactly news. It has long since been obvious that many legislators are in the pocket of the gun lobby. Yet this made a big noise. First of all, why? And secondly, if you were trying to plan some sort of grassroots uprising against the NRA, what would you prescribe?
I'd argue it's happening right now, certainly in the way that activists are organizing and are taking to the Hill. Some of the survivors of gun violence whose stories are so powerful. I, from time to time, click on the tweets of lawmakers who are now saying things like Obama's executive actions are going to undermine the Second Amendment. And what I see are everyday Americans with their own Twitter accounts doing basically the same thing I did, asking those lawmakers, how much money did you take from the NRA? Did the NRA tell you to say this? Because people aren't buying the fact that simply expanding the definition of what it means to be a gun dealer is some kind of infringement on the Second Amendment.
Igor, many thanks.
Thank you.
Igor Volsky is a contributing editor for thinkprogress.org. The NRA's lobbying seems as inevitable as death and taxes, but that wasn't always the case. After Sandy Hook in 2012, we spoke to Adam Winkler, UCLA law professor and author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America. He told us there was a time when the NRA supported gun control, back when the Black Panthers were the ones passionately advocating gun rights, because the Panthers determined the government was either unwilling or unable to protect the lives of black people. So they started publicly packing heat. Here's one of the movement's leaders, Huey Newton, from a documentary called The Black Panthers, Vanguard of the Revolution, by filmmaker Stanley Nelson.
The California Penal Code, Section 12020 through 12027, and also the Second Amendment of the Constitution, guarantees the citizen a right to bear arms on public property.
Adam Winkler.
One of the surprising things I discovered in writing Gunfight was that when the Black Panthers started carrying their guns around in Oakland, California in the late 1960s, it inspired a new wave of gun control laws. It was these laws that ironically sparked a backlash among rural white conservatives who were concerned that government was coming to get their guns next. The NRA mimicked many of the policy positions of the Black Panthers, who viewed guns not just as a matter of protection for the home, but something you should be able to have out on the street, and also protection against a hostile government that was tyrannical and disrespectful of people's rights.
There was an incident with a traffic stop. Huey Newton and Bobby Seale were sitting in a car, lightly armed.
They refused to give up their firearms. The police officer says, "What are you doing with those firearms?" But Huey Newton had gone to law school for a short time and had learned that in California it was lawful for him to be carrying loaded weapons as long as he carried them openly. In fact, the most dramatic incident was when the Black Panthers, 30 of them, showed up at the California State Capitol armed with loaded rifles, pistols, and shotgun and marched right into the legislative chamber while it was in session.
The state assembly was in the midst of a heated debate when the young Negroes, armed with loaded rifles, shotguns, and pistols, marched into the Capitol.
In fact, they were debating a gun control law, and the Panthers were there not to do violence, but to protest this gun control law.
This episode freaked out conservative politicians, including the governor of California, who could not for the life of him imagine a situation where a lawful American would want to carry a loaded weapon in public.
I don't think that loaded guns is the way to solve a problem that should be solved between people of goodwill. And anyone who would approve of this kind of demonstration must be out of their mind.
What was the name of that governor?
That was Ronald Reagan, who would go on to become the first presidential candidate ever endorsed by the NRA. And of course, his politics did shift. He was an astute political strategist, and he understood by 1980 that he needed to support gun rights to keep his new right coalition together. And he was such an opponent of gun control when he was in office that even after he was the victim of an assassination attempt, he pushed for no new restrictive gun laws.
So tell me more about the origins of the National Rifle Association, and when did they become radicalized along Second Amendment lines?
The NRA was formed right after the Civil War by two former Union soldiers who were convinced that it was the poor marksmanship of Union soldiers that had allowed the war to go on so long. In the 1920s and 1930s, the NRA was a supporter of gun control, pushing states to adopt restrictive laws on concealed carry of firearms. In the 1960s and 70s, a series of assassinations like Martin Luther King and Robert F. Kennedy and the race riots and the Black Panthers all led to a new wave of gun control laws. The NRA became divided between those who thought guns were primarily about hunting and recreation and those who thought guns were about personal protection against criminals in urban environments. Those hardliners ended up staging a coup at the annual membership meeting one year and replaced the entire leadership of the NRA with a group of hardliners who were committed to fighting gun control at all costs.
This was a schism that occurred at a point when the existing leadership of the NRA really wanted to move out west and focus on hunting.
That's right. I think of how different politics in America would be had the leaders of the NRA in the early 1970s carried through with their plan to retreat from political activity, move to Colorado Springs, and focus the organization on outdoors activities. That didn't happen, of course, and the NRA became committed to a very extreme view of the Second Amendment that really fought against any new gun control proposals under the theory that any new law was a slippery slope towards total civilian disarmament. And that view has really shaped gun rights in America ever since.
Adam, thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Adam Winkler is a professor of law at UCLA and author of Gunfight, The Battle Over the Right to Bear Arms in America.
Coming up, is America really so divided over the issue of gun control?
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Central to the president's gun safety message this week was the assertion that the reforms he's advocating reflect what most Americans want.
And what's often ignored in this debate is that a majority of gun owners actually agree. A majority of gun owners agree that we can respect the Second Amendment while keeping an irresponsible, law-breaking few from inflicting harm on a massive scale.
In his speech, the president insisted that it's Congress, not the American public, that's divided when it comes to reforming national gun policy.
Until we have a Congress that's in line with the majority of Americans, there are actions within my legal authority that we can take to help reduce gun violence and save more lives.
Wait, the Congress is out of step with the mainstream about guns? That's not what we're hearing on TV.
A Pew Research Center poll shows Americans are almost evenly split on whether it's more important to control guns versus protect gun ownership.
Americans are more closely divided on rights and the effectiveness of gun laws. 47% say it's more important to protect gun rights, while 50% say it is the need to control gun ownership.
But Americans are deeply divided. In our latest poll, asked which is a higher priority, 46% said new gun control laws, 47% said protecting the right to own guns.
So, which is it? How much consensus is there really on this issue? And if Obama is right, where does this persistent idea about a nation divided come from? Health policy scholar Colleen Barry has some thoughts on that. She's co-director of the Johns Hopkins Center for Mental Health and Addiction Policy Research. Colleen, welcome to OTM.
Glad to be here.
I gather some of the disconnect stems from one particular tracking poll that is kind of a benchmark for measuring the public's mind on this question. Tell me about the Pew poll.
Yep. So the Pew Center poll asks respondents, what do you think is more important, to protect the rights of Americans to own guns or to control gun ownership? And they've been asking this question for about 20 years, which is great to be able to track opinion over time. However, there are a number of real concerns about the Pew Center question.
Because the language, you should excuse the expression, is loaded.
The concept of priming is well established in social science research, and it suggests that using terms like rights versus controls may prime respondents in a manner that could bias their responses. So generally, we think of rights as good things and control as less desirable. And this type of priming may be more pronounced as we've moved into an increasingly politically polarized time.
But beyond the incendiary possibilities of the language, there's also the question of its lack of specificity. You've learned that when you get a little more granular, the opinions seem to magically change.
That's exactly right. In the weeks following the Sandy Hook tragedy, I learned that most of what we knew about public attitudes around gun policy were these questions like the Pew question that capture a general public mood. And so we went into the field to collect, using rigorous research methods, data on public attitudes for 30 different specific policies.
Give me some examples of some of the policies that the respondents as a whole tended to endorse.
Our survey found very high levels of support for background checks for all gun sales, over 80% support among gun owners and non-gunners alike. Americans, including gun owners in majorities, supported a whole range of policies to restrict guns from people who are at highest risk for gun-related incidents, including prohibiting people convicted of domestic violence, prohibiting a person on a terrorist watch list, requiring prison time for persons knowingly selling a gun to a person who is prohibited, gun violence restraining order policies like the one that was just enacted in California.
Now, as you mentioned, this seminal bit of research happened right in the aftermath of Sandy Hook. Clearly, the public was sensitized to the dangers of guns in the society, so sensitized that maybe these results are themselves dubious. What did you do to correct for the recency effect?
What we ended up doing was going back into the field in January of 2015, where there were no major events that occurred, and asking those same questions related to different policies. And I was genuinely surprised that for the majority of policies, we saw virtually no differences in support over time and between gun owners and non-gun owners.
Now, Colleen, you are not a gun policy expert. You're a public health policy researcher, and you made what I regard to be a kind of shocking discovery that on this major, major issue, there turns out to be very, very little data for Congress or anyone else to consult.
That's exactly right. The last study that had been done, published related to Americans' attitudes on gun policy, was over a decade old. And that was what motivated us to conduct our study in 2013 originally.
That's phenomenal. So if you want to know about Americans' views on abortion, there's an embarrassment of riches. If you want to know about Americans' views on taxation, troves of opinion data. But when it's guns in society, there's bupkis.
We have had a very challenging time in this country doing research on any issues related to gun policy, in part because of the difficulty of getting funding, including federal funding, for gun policy research.
Colleen, thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.
Colleen Barry is a professor of health policy at Johns Hopkins University.
The dearth of polls charting public opinion on gun violence that Colleen Barry noticed when she set out to write a survey on the topic is part of a larger shortage of any public health research on firearms. And it can be traced back to a 1996 measure slashing the CDC's budget for gun studies. The absence of up-to-date research on gun violence was something President Obama noted in his speech with a hint of exasperation.
With more research, we could further improve gun safety, just as with more research, we've reduced traffic fatalities enormously over the last 30 years. We do research when cars, food, medicine, even toys harm people so that we make them safer. And you know what? Research, science, those are good things. They work.
Todd Swillick is Washington correspondent for The Takeaway. We spoke to him at the beginning of December, right after the shooting in San Bernardino, California. I asked him to take us back to when this all started. It was 1993 when the New England Journal of Medicine published a CDC-funded study that found, quote, keeping a gun in the home was strongly and independently associated with an increased risk of homicide.
Right. And this is the study, you know, when you hear it's more dangerous to have a gun in the home than it is to not have one. You hear that all the time. Mm-hmm. This is the study that showed that. That was 1993. And by 1995 and into 1996, the National Rifle Association started to lean on members of Congress to say, hey, this study that came out that was funded by the Centers for Disease Control, this is taxpayer money, they're advocating for gun control. We don't want you paying for this.
So that brings us to Representative Jay Dickey of Arkansas, who attached an amendment to a 1996 omnibus appropriations bill.
And it says none of the funds made available for injury prevention and control at the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention may be used to advocate or promote gun control. That's all it said. And you say, well, that's not a ban. That doesn't tell people what to study. But here's the problem. before they introduced this amendment, Brooke, they slashed the funding for the CDC by $2.4 million, the exact amount that had been used for this research in the Injury Prevention and Control Fund. And what message did that send? It said, you can do whatever research you want, but if you report your research and that research tacitly or directly advocates for gun control, you're going to be breaking the rules.
The issue seems to be that the NRA equated gun violence research with anti-gun political advocacy.
And Jay Dickey himself has talked about that, that back at this time, you have to remember how contentious the gun debate was. It's contentious now, but it was really in play. I mean, they had the assault weapons ban of 1994. That had just happened. The NRA thought that public health researchers, if they went into the medical journals or on the airwaves and said, my research shows that we would be safer if there were fewer guns available or if it were harder to buy a gun, yeah, they saw that as gun control, and maybe it was advocating for gun control. Nevertheless, this was the action that they leaned on members of Congress to take, and they took it.
So what kind of information don't we have, do you think, because of this ban?
Well, I think we don't know a lot about how guns hurt people in the real world. How more likely are you to injure someone else or injure yourself with a firearm if there's alcohol in the house? How is it connected to people's income? Are people with lower incomes at higher risk? I think there are a great number of things that researchers would like to know. What is it that leads to the situations where a gun can hurt a person? It's hard to imagine any other area of human harm where 33,000 people die and 85,000 are injured, by the way, where the primary government research public health agency isn't permitted to study it.
And the same research ban was extended to the National Institutes of Health with almost the same language a few years ago. But Todd, after the shooting at that historic church in Charleston, South Carolina in July, an amendment was proposed that would have reversed the CDC research ban that you reported didn't go anywhere.
And I turned around and asked John Boehner, who was then the Speaker of the House, about it.
And he offered you this now famous reply.
Listen, the CDC is there to look at diseases that need to be dealt with to protect the public health. I'm sorry, but a gun is not a disease. And guns don't kill people. People do. And when people use weapons in a horrible way, we should condemn the actions of the individual and not blame the action on some weapon.
Well, an automobile is not a disease, and it kills the same number of people as guns every year. A bacteria is not a disease, for that matter. So I think from the epidemiologist's perspective, that statement from the political sphere on Capitol Hill was really, really hard to take.
So let's talk about the man whose name is on that ban, Jay Dickey. He went through something of a conversion.
Yeah, Jay Dickey has come out. He's been talking to reporters to issue his apology. He basically said, look, this was a hot debate in the 90s. I thought that a government agency was advocating for gun control, and I did think that that was inappropriate. But I wish we hadn't gone as far. I wish they were doing the research. I wish we knew more.
Is it because he's no longer in office that he can take this position?
Almost certainly. I mean, I don't want to try to imagine or speculate what Jay Dickey would say if he were still an elected official. Who knows? But it's certainly easier for him now that he's no longer a member of Congress. Look, Brooke, this is about whether or not a public health agency can study a public health matter. And I think most people know that. But I had a conversation with a senior Republican aide here on Capitol Hill a few weeks ago and asked, are you going to undo this thing? You just have to strike 20 words and it's gone. And this Republican aide said, look, to you and me in this building, it's the Dickey Amendment. Outside of this building and outside the Beltway, that's called gun control. So the answer is no.
Todd, thank you very much.
Brooke, it's a pleasure.
Todd Zwillick is Washington correspondent for The Takeaway from PRI and WNYC.
Coming up, so now we know America's opinion about gun control. Does it matter?
This is On the Media.
This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. So, a few minutes ago, we learned that, in fact, when asked about specifics, most people support basic gun control, whether or not they own a gun. So now we know. But does it matter? Does an overwhelming consensus on an issue translate into policy? Well, in 2014, Martin Gillens of Princeton and Benjamin Page of Northwestern University published a study looking at exactly that question. Who rules, they asked. The answer, not you, unless you're economically in America's top 10%. Really, they proved what we already suspected. The majority simply can't move the needle on policy without that sweet elite cash on their side. Interest groups, as you could have guessed, also out-influence average people, and interest groups representing rich people are bigger influencers than most. Except, and here's where it gets interesting, there's an outlier, the National Rifle Association. Benjamin Page, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
You graphed the likelihood that a policy would be adopted based on how many average citizens wanted it, and it seemed that whether it was 10% of them or 90% of them, the result was a flat line. What did that flat line represent?
It does not mean that average people never get what they want, because if they happen to agree with interest groups or the affluent, they do tend to get what they want, and that's actually fairly common. That's one of the reasons you don't see people screaming in the streets.
You also found in your study interest groups that represent financial elites, like bankers, say, they're more effective in influencing policy than groups that represent regular folk, right? Is that just because elite special interests have more money?
They have more groups and more money. Business groups have about twice as much influence as other interest groups. And that includes big mass membership groups, groups of seniors, labor unions, women's groups. All of them fade to almost nothing compared to the power of business groups.
So that brings us to the NRA. I described it in the intro as an outlier. Why?
The NRA is one of the most effective interest groups that's not primarily a business group. It's actually unusual to have such overwhelming public majorities for policies like registration, licensing, no assault rifles, that sort of thing, and yet have essentially no policy response. So that's one respect in which it's an outlier.
And correct me if I'm wrong here, part of the reason why the NRA is an outlier is because its members are not, generally speaking, particularly affluent, and yet it wields this enormous influence.
That's right. It's a little bit tricky because it's hard to tell how important gun manufacturers are in the financing of the NRA. A lot of that is just difficult to know.
Mm-hmm.
I suspect that the makers of guns and ammunition spend a fair amount of money helping the NRA have gun-friendly policies.
Do we have any data that suggests the NRA doesn't particularly represent the majority of its membership when it comes to policy issues?
I'm not sure about its membership, but what we do know is gun owners. Gun owners are perfectly happy with background checks. They don't want criminals having guns.
But I still don't understand why the NRA wields so much influence.
What the NRA has that's very unusual is they have both money and troops on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
The last few times we've had gun legislation, politicians noticed that fairly small numbers of people can dominate results, especially in primaries. A lot of public officials who voted for gun control got kicked out of office, not because most of their constituents opposed it, but rather because a small group of people could have a lot of influence. That kind of takes us to the larger picture, it seems to me, that guns are just one example of a number of problems with democracy in the United States.
So how does one change this kind of dynamic?
There's a whole big menu of things we can do. Some are easy. If people pester public officials enough, we can get them done pretty easily. Others are very hard, things like disclosure. when people know that candidates are being funded by big money, they can retaliate. But that takes a lot of public information.
Do we need the rich people to stand with the not rich people?
You really need a broad coalition. And the last time there were major political reforms, the last two times would be in the New Deal and back in the populist and progressive period.
The beginning of the last century.
That's right. In both cases, there were some very wealthy people who were helpful in reforms.
Like the Roosevelts.
The Roosevelts themselves. But in fact, they worked closely with some major business people, executives of General Electric, Standard Oil, and so forth, to develop a lot of policies that actually were quite beneficial to average people, but prevented revolution. That was one motive.
So if we've got pester your congressman, disclosure, getting rich people involved.
My candidate for your number four strategy would be get organized. And there are really a lot of grassroots organizations that are stirring.
Paul Krugman of the New York Times wrote that there's a danger to your study. There's a risk of concluding that electoral politics is irrelevant because the economic elite get their way either way. So how can we consider this study and not feel just entirely hopeless about democracy?
That was a wake-up call for us. When he said that, we started being more clear, I think. First of all, that elections do make an enormous difference. But secondly, we need to improve the way they're run.
But is it because Americans that may feel very differently from the people that they've put in office have dropped the ball on their own democracy?
No, I quite strongly disagree with that.
They don't vote in primaries. Where's the outrage?
Well, the outrage is pretty hard to muster over things that are made as invisible as possible, and that includes a lot of lobbying activity in Washington.
Fair enough, but there's nothing more visible than a bunch of kids being mowed down in a Connecticut suburb.
That's true, but think about primary elections and how our officials are nominated, particularly for the House of Representatives. It's very common to have a party primary in which only 15 or 20% of the people vote. Now, you could say, oh, they're apathetic, but these elections are held at strange times. A lot of people have no clue they're coming along. The whole system is arranged so that a small number of activists, like gun activists, can actually sway the outcome of elections.
And why is it so hard to muster a small group of people on the other side?
If you look around the world, there are plenty of places that don't have this problem. And the big difference is the way the electoral system works.
True. In Australia, they fine you, just an inexpensive little fine, if you don't vote. And that seems to create a social norm where voting is expected.
That's right. And of course, having a holiday for elections, that's true almost everywhere except the United States. Having automatic registration instead of forcing people to go through a song and dance to prove who they are and where they live and so forth. In most countries, the government organizes that. We make it hard for people to vote.
Based on your study, if you were going to respond to Paul Krugman, say, or to the listeners of this interview, who have just learned, if they didn't already know, that unless they happen to agree with the top 10% earners in this country, it doesn't matter how many of them feel strongly about an issue, they're only going to get a 0.3% opportunity to move the needle on policy. What would you say to stave off despair?
What we've done is help people see how bad things are, and the next thing to do is to fix them. I firmly believe that Americans are capable of doing that, and it's going to take a big movement of people working hard. It's going to take both Republicans and Democrats.
And rich people.
And rich people, as well as poor people. But if poor people get really organized, they can give a bit of a scare to the rich people, and that's all to the good.
Benjamin, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Benjamin Page is a political science professor at Northwestern and co-author with Martin Gillens of the study Testing Theories of American Politics, Elites, Interest Groups, and Average Citizens, published in the journal Perspectives on Politics in 2014.
So far, the bulk of the momentum, such as it is, around gun control has come after high-profile mass shootings like Sandy Hook. We heard it from the president in his address this week.
Every time I think about those kids, it gets me mad. And by the way, it happens on the streets of Chicago every day.
He's used that line about Chicago before, but though it was only one line in a lengthy address, it is black men who make up the largest share of shooting homicides every year. In 2012, for example, 90 people died in shootings like Aurora and Sandy Hook. That year, according to ProPublica, nearly 6,000 black men were killed.
That's why community leaders like Reverend Michael McBride have trekked to the White House urging support for existing gang intervention programs, programs with solid track records and without political baggage. But time after time, McBride finds that he and his colleagues are unable to get traction or investment to build on their success. McBride is a pastor based in Berkeley, California, who champions one program in particular called Ceasefire. We learned about it in a ProPublica New Republic piece this fall. Ceasefire relies on partnerships among community groups and law enforcement, and it works because they only need to intervene in the lives of a very few to save the lives of many.
Less than half of 1% of a given community is responsible for over 60% of gun violence. And we find that when you intervene with these young men, over time, they actually choose to stop shooting without any extra force or pressure because many of them want to live. They just have not had anyone, whether it is community members, law enforcement, or others, really give them a constructive way to make those kind of decisions.
Now, the program has basically two elements. One is a really tough no-tolerance policy. Lots of warrants if someone has a gun, long sentences for chronic offenders, aggressive enforcement of probation restrictions, and even calling in the feds.
We call it a carrot and a stick approach, right? We want the stick to definitely be a deterrent to those that are caught in these cycles of violence. The carrot would be offering jobs, mentors, offering services, offering them even relocation as we call them into conversations to say, we love you. We don't want to see you die or end up in jail, but this gun violence must stop.
So tell me how well it's worked.
In cities like Oakland, Stockton, California, Richmond, California, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Camden, New Jersey, High Point, North Carolina, Boston, parts of Baltimore, we can average between 15 to 20, some places as high as 30 and 40% reductions of gun-related homicides within 18 months. Now, to put that in context, if a police department or a city has a 4 to 5% reduction in homicides, it is considered a great year of success. The Department of Justice lists this as one of its highest-rated interventions, so I believe it should be advocated for right alongside every background check intervention, every assault weapons ban.
In his speech this week, the president singled out the gun lobby as the primary hurdle to reforms that could tackle gun violence. But Ceasefire is an approach that doesn't require passing new gun laws. It doesn't involve a battle with the NRA. And yet it has struggled to gain any meaningful political traction. Why isn't this approach being embraced by politicians?
The challenge we have, I believe, is are the lives of black young men who are commonly referred to as thugs, criminals, predators, are their lives really worth saving through investments that go beyond police and jails? Have we made that argument yet in the national consciousness? And I would say no. The president is very much responding to a political reality that we see playing out every day in cities all across the country. Mayors, police chiefs, city council members, governors. It's a hard sell to say that we're going to move several million dollars away from one type of law enforcement or incarceral strategy to something that would actually expect these young men to make life-saving decisions.
Harvard researcher Thomas Apt told ProPublica that Ceasefire, quote, has no natural constituency. To vastly oversimplify, progressives want more prevention and conservatives want more enforcement. Focused deterrence challenges the orthodoxy on both sides. It makes everybody uncomfortable. Do you agree with that?
His analysis is correct, but just even the use of no natural constituency in everyone definitely privileges the middle-class, affluent, white constituency over and against those who live in these communities every day. And that is, again, part and parcel of the problem.
Because, as you've suggested, the policy wonks on this issue are often white middle-class individuals, and so the strategies are directed kind of towards the suburbs.
Absolutely, but we have to continue to figure out how do we widen the circle of concern so the constituencies are not invisible to those who are actually making the kinds of political decisions at the local, state, and federal level.
I'm guessing you experienced some of that invisibility when you went to the White House for a specific meeting about gun violence after Newtown. Could you tell me about that meeting?
We actually brought 70 multiracial, multi-faith leaders from across the country to even help lift up testimonies and conversations about this. And we had to help them nuance the way they understood mental health, because mental health in their conversations were taking the Newtown shooter as a profile. There was never a conversation that the young brother in the neighborhood, the young sister in the neighborhood, is suffering from a mental health challenge of trauma, post-traumatic stress disorder, et cetera. So the frames themselves continue to leave out the directly most impacted individuals on a regular basis. So it's not even just about the programmatic interventions that we were asking for, but it's also just the blind spot as it relates to how our own communities are rendered invisible in these conversations in the inner city when we talk about even the things we are feeling could work as a universal intervention.
Well, do you have any hope that the measures the president announced this week, more background checks, more enforcement, more gun safety technology, will make a real dent in the majority of gun deaths in this country?
I believe in the background check interventions. I believe in the technology. I believe that's going to happen over time. Part of our sense of urgency is we know that we can save lives in the next week, in the next month, in the next year. And we don't want to wait years and electoral cycles before we're able to actually have the political will to get this stuff done. We want to do it now. We need to do it now. I think most people just don't know. And how would they know without there being a more visible, aggressive public campaign to show that we do have solutions that work?
So you believe the more people know about it, the more support they'll give. But what if people just don't care because these communities are as far away from them as, you know, Iraq?
Right. Well, I think we have to continue to make the argument to folks that they're paying for it. Every homicide in a city costs $2 million per homicide to the taxpayer, according to the Center for Disease Control, according to the RAND Corporation. So we're paying for the carnage that is happening in our communities. So we may have to make an economic argument. We have found that that's compelling for many conservative and Republican individuals, but we found that many of them are very much compelled by a redemptive narrative connected to their faith and moral values. So when we put stories and successes in front of people, people really do open up their hearts and their minds to figure out how can we actually make these investments and these strategic partnerships happen. It's going to be a continued effort, but it is something that many of us, like I said, wake up every day. We don't have the luxury to lose hope or to tap out.
Michael, thank you very much.
Well, thank you so much.
Michael McBride is a pastor in Berkeley, California, and founder of The Way Christian Center. He advocates for the ceasefire violence intervention model in cities around the country.
He wasn't in the wrong place at the wrong time. He hadn't made a bad decision. He was exactly where any other kid would be. Your kid. My kids. And then gunmen started firing. And Xavion, who was in high school, hadn't even gotten started in life, dove on top of three girls to shield them from the bullets. And he was shot in the head. and the girls were spared. He gave his life to save theirs. An act of heroism a lot bigger than anything we should ever expect from a 15-year-old.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media is produced by Kimmy Regler, Mira Sharma, Alana Casanova-Burgess, Jesse Brenneman, and Mythili Rao. We had more help from Alex Friedland, and our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Casey Means.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. On the Media is a production of WNYC Studios. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio.